And for those who would automatically equate firepower with crime, I cite the example of Switzerland, among others. There's more firepower per capita in the Swiss population than arguably any place else, yet they do not have the crime problem that we have. Therefore, it is other sociological variables and not the presence of firearms that is responsible for America being the violent society that it is. However, an armed population is a population that could potentially at least successfully resist the implementation of martial law. And I think the complaints about immigration, the hue and cry to remove firearms or the accessibility to firearms from the American people, and the growing sentiment on behalf of euthanasia are in fact all connected, and they are in fact seemingly disconnected items which will figure prominently and disastrously in the implementation of a Fourth Reich in the United States, which I think will be the outcome of an economic collapse. Indeed, to a certain extent at least, because of the publicity that euthanasia has achieved through the works of Dr. Jack Kevorkian, Dr. Death, there is a growing tendency, there is a rush toward euthanasia legislation in various states. Now, I would note again in the miscellaneous archive show euthanasia in contemporary America and Nazi Germany, the development of, first of all, mainstream intellectual movements, the International Mental Hygiene Movement, the associated and derivative International Eugenics Movement, and the in turn associated and derivative International Euthanasia Movement, all led directly to the T4 program in Germany, which led to the euthanasia which spawned the euthanasia program in Germany, and it was the German euthanasia programs which led directly to the massive extermination programs of the Third Reich. And indeed, as we looked at in that miscellaneous archive show, the mainstream intellectual movements, the International Mental Hygiene Movement and the International Eugenics Movement, had some of their most significant proponents here in the United States. And there were many well-connected mainstream American intellectuals who agreed with the outlook of the Nazi scientists and sociologists with regard to, quote, improving the race, unquote. Eugenics involves the manipulation by the way of human reproduction in such a way as to promote a, quote, healthier species, unquote, i.e., promoting births among genetic types that are favored, hindering births, including ultimately the elimination of life on the part of people who are deemed undesirable. That is the science or practice of eugenics. And it was the German eugenicists, and in turn eugenics growing directly out of the International Mental Hygiene Movement, who led directly to the Nazi euthanasia programs and the Tiergartenstrasse 4 program, which in turn led to the German extermination programs such as the Holocaust, the elimination of gays, gypsies, and others. Another point that should be restated is that the actual legal loophole, or the legal door, the crack in the legal armament, which led to the implementation of the T4 program, the euthanasia program, and the extermination programs, was the Naur case. By the way, that's spelled K-N-A-U-E-R. A German couple named Naur had a horribly deformed baby. They petitioned Adolf Hitler, the Führer, for permission to have that child put to sleep, the argument being that they couldn't care for the child. Hitler dispatched his personal physician, who examined the child and recommended that permission be granted to eliminate that child. Permission was granted by the Führer, and the edict he issued served as the legal pretext for the Nazi euthanasia programs, which, first of all, accustomed the German people to the elimination of humanity that was deemed extra or superfluous. And beyond that, the people who were to staff the gas chambers and killing centers of the Holocaust were trained in the euthanasia program. And again, it was the euthanasia program that led to the Nazi extermination programs. And I am afraid that if euthanasia becomes accepted in the United States, and there's certainly something to be said for relieving hopeless suffering, but it is a very touchy subject, and it is a very delicate one, because opening that door may very well open the legal door to a future Holocaust here in the United States. The New York Times from May 9th of 1994 contained the following op-ed column on page A11. It's by Walter Reich, R-E-I-C-H, a physician, senior scholar, and director of the Project on Health Science and Public Policy at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. The column is entitled by the New York Times, First, Do No Harm. And skipping down into it, we find, if the floodgates of legalized, formalized, medically assisted suicide were opened so that it became fully legal for a physician to respond to patients' requests for help to die, requests would pour in that would not resemble the extreme ones now used to justify such help. This last paragraph again. If the floodgates of legalized, formalized, medically assisted suicide were opened so that it became fully legal for physicians to respond to patients' requests for help to die, requests would pour in that would not resemble the extreme ones now used to justify such help. Remember the Naur case, my interjection, of course. Continuing. No matter how many restrictions were put in place to limit the circumstances under which physicians might assist in suicides, for example, the patient is near death, in severe pain, and free of suicidal depression, such restrictions could never be made tight or clear enough to totally bar assistance to those who did not qualify. Such individuals might have a significant lifespan ahead, but prefer for a variety of reasons not to live. They might have pain that is, in fact, controllable by medications. They might feel discouraged because they cannot function at the same level they once did, or believe that their illness burdens their family. This could lead them to try to convince doctors that they should be helped to die, and doctors could accede to their wishes. Finally, some families, for financial or other reasons, might put pressure on physicians to take active measures leading to death. Such a possibility brings to mind the most atrocious experience of all, in which physicians killed patients who did not want to die. The experience of Nazi Germany's, quote, euthanasia program, unquote. That many of the victims were killed by carbon monoxide in vans makes the image of Dr. Kevorkian's gassing van particularly disturbing. It appears that the slippery slope on which we have been put by the Kevorkian case might become an even more slippery, sharply downhill road because of new and pending legal developments. Indeed, that from the New York Times of May 9th, 1994, a Monday, specifically on page A11, that column by Walter Reich. Indeed, I think not only pending legal developments, but pending economic developments might also propel us even farther down that slippery slope toward a euthanasia program, which could have the same ultimate results as the Third Reich's euthanasia program. What we're going to take a look at next is the profound relationship between the American eugenics movement, American eugenics legislation, and the German eugenicists and the German eugenics legislation, which led directly to that Nazi euthanasia program that was alluded to by Walter Reich in that column. This segment of the broadcast this evening is going to go into the archives as an addendum to the miscellaneous archive show, Euthanasia in Contemporary America and Nazi Germany. We're going to rely for much of the material concerning the American and German racist eugenicists on an important new book. That book is entitled The Nazi Connection, subtitled Eugenics, American Racism, and German National Socialism. It's authored by Stefan Kuhl, capital K-U, umlaut H-L. It's published in hardcover by the Oxford University Press, and it is copyrighted 1994. I'm going to give a summation of the book from the dust jacket, and then we're going to delve into portions of the text. When Hitler published Mein Kampf in 1924, he held up a foreign law as a model for his program of racial purification. The U.S. Immigration Restriction Act, which prohibited the immigration of those with hereditary illnesses and entire ethnic groups. Note, a foreign law was the model for Hitler's program of racial purification. The U.S. Immigration Restriction Act. Just take a look at the volatile debate in the contemporary American political society about what to do about illegal immigrants, quote unquote. Continuing, or recapping that last sentence, or recouping, when Hitler published Mein Kampf in 1924, he held up a foreign law as a model for his program of racial purification. The U.S. Immigration Restriction Act, which prohibited the immigration of those with hereditary illnesses and entire ethnic groups. When the Nazis took power in 1933, they installed a program of eugenics, the attempted, quote, improvement, unquote, of the population through forced sterilization and marriage controls that consciously drew on the U.S. example. By then, many American states had long had compulsory sterilization laws for, quote, defectives, unquote, upheld by the Supreme Court in 1927. Small wonder that the Nazi laws led one eugenics activist in Virginia to complain, quote, the Germans are beating us at our own game, unquote. In The Nazi Connection, Stefan Kuhl uncovers the ties between the American eugenics movement and the Nazi program of racial hygiene, showing that many American scientists actively supported Hitler's policies. After introducing us to the recently resurgent problem of scientific racism, Kuhl carefully recounts the history of the eugenics movement both in the United States and internationally, demonstrating how widely the idea of sterilization as a genetic control had become accepted by the early 20th century. From the first, American eugenicists led the way with radical ideas. Their influence led to sterilization laws in dozens of states, laws which were studied carefully by the German racial hygienists. With the rise of Hitler, the Germans enacted compulsory sterilization laws partly based on the U.S. experience, and American eugenicists took pride in their influence on Nazi policies. Kuhl recreates astonishing scenes of American eugenicists traveling to Germany to study the new laws, publishing scholarly articles lionizing the Nazi eugenics program, and proudly comparing personal notes from Hitler thanking them for their books. Even after the outbreak of war, he writes, the American eugenicists frowned upon Hitler's totalitarian government, but not his sterilization laws. By 1945, when the murderous nature of the Nazi government was made perfectly clear, the American eugenicists sought to downplay the close connections between themselves and the German program. Some of them, in fact, had sought to distance themselves from Hitler even before the war. But Stefan Kuhl's deeply documented book provides a devastating indictment of the influence and aid provided by American scientists for the most comprehensive attempt to enforce racial purity in world history. And again, bear in mind that it was the Nazi euthanasia programs which led to the other better known and more comprehensive extermination programs. The first item that we're going to look at in our examination of the Nazi Connection by Stefan Kuhl concerns the foundation for the perceived necessity for eugenics legislation in the United States. Indeed, the German eugenicists who drew on the writings and legislation of their American counterparts saw the importance of American eugenics legislation for Germany as lying in the fact that America was the leading eugenics power or eugenicist power in the world. And the explanation given by the Nazi eugenicists, and bear in mind that it was their works which laid the intellectual foundation for the Third Reich's extermination programs, the explanation for the exemplary nature of American eugenics legislation for Germany was that the United States needed eugenics so that its white population could be fortified against the, quote, ravages, unquote, of racial mixing or race mixing. Indeed, the fact that America was a racially pluralistic society was viewed as pivotal by the Germans for the necessity of America in implementing eugenics legislation. The presence, in short, of people of color in American society and the multiracial and pluralistic nature of American society was viewed both by the German eugenicists, who spawned the Nazi extermination programs, and their American counterparts, who served as their role models. It was the multiracial, pluralistic nature of American society which necessitated eugenics legislation in the United States in order to keep America's white population, quote, pure, unquote. The multiracial, pluralistic nature of American society, its relationship to the American eugenics theorists and American eugenics legislation as perceived by the German eugenicists is described by Stefan Kuhl as follows. Reading now from the Nazi Connection. The importance of the United States for German eugenicists was revealed by the allusions in nearly every German medical dissertation about sterilization in the United States as the first country to enforce comprehensive eugenics legislation. These dissertations often refer to literature by Geisa von Hoffmann, Hans W. Meyer, M-A-I-E-R, and Laughlin, L-A-U-G-H-L-I-N. That's Harry H. Laughlin, a leading American eugenicist. Continuing, one explanation given for the United States' leading role in eugenics was that racial conflicts in the United States had forced the white population early on to employ a systematic program of race improvement. That last sentence again. One explanation given for the United States' leading role in eugenics was that racial conflicts in the United States had forced the white population early on to employ a systematic program of race improvement. The dissertations normally supported the compulsory character of American sterilization, but were critical concerning the lack of enforcement. Now, I cite the multiracial and pluralistic nature of American society and its perceived importance, the importance perceived by the Germans for of that multiracial, pluralistic nature of society for American eugenics theory and implementation. And bear in mind that it was the American example, both intellectually and judicially, that served as, to a certain extent at least, the intellectual and judicial foundation for the German eugenics programs, which were the foundation for the Nazi racial policies and their extermination programs. I cite the multiracial, pluralistic nature of American society in that context because that multiracial and pluralistic society is once again, or perhaps is the word still, serving as the basis for justification of arguments that are very similar to the arguments that served as the pretext not only for American eugenics legislation, but across the sea in a more ominous echo of same, the eugenics legislation and the eugenics programs which led directly to the extermination programs of the Third Reich. Just as I have cited in the past, the pivotal connection between American industrialists and financiers and their counterparts in Germany, though, and as well as Italy, those connections absolutely central to the story of the rise of fascism in Europe, so too the connections between American intellectuals, American eugenicists, and their counterparts in Germany is absolutely central to the understanding, or to an understanding, of not only how the Third Reich came to be, but how its extermination programs could first of all have been undertaken, and second of all, how those extermination programs could have been winked at, and how people involved in those extermination programs, and people who had voiced similar views to the views which led to those programs, were able not only to escape justice, but to perpetuate that method of thinking and that type of action into the contemporary period. An element which I think serves to illustrate the significance of an understanding of the relationship between the American and German eugenicists, and in turn the relationship between the eugenics movement and the Nazi extermination programs, the Pioneer Fund and people associated with it, I think, serve to illustrate the importance of this understanding for contemporary Americans, indeed, for all men and women of a good faith in the contemporary world, because the implications of what I'm about to discuss go far beyond the United States. There may be members of the listening audience who are thinking that, well, this has nothing to do with me, it has nothing to do with the world that I live in. Who cares about a bunch of eugenicists in the 1920s and 30s, whether they were here or in Germany? Well, in fact, there are direct, readily verifiable, and ongoing connections between the American intellectual milieu, which served as the model for the German eugenics program and extermination programs, and their counterparts in Germany. An institution which constitutes a very profound and ongoing historical link with the German and American eugenicists of the 20s and 30s and the racist theorists and eugenicists of the contemporary period here in the United States and elsewhere is something called the Pioneer Fund. And one of the individuals who has received support from the Pioneer Fund is an anthropologist named Roger Pearson, someone we dealt with, by the way, in our Aryan Nations program, Radio Free America, Aryan Nations series, Radio Free America programs 10 through 13. We later came up against Mr. Pearson later in the context of the World Anti-Communist League, Radio Free America shows 14 and 15. Roger Pearson and the Pioneer Fund, which has helped to finance his work, represents a profound element of continuity between the American and German eugenicists of the 20s and 30s, whose views and actions led directly to the Nazi extermination programs, and viewpoints and potential legislative actions which could lay a similar foundation for a contemporary extermination program in the United States or elsewhere. Now, as we examine Roger Pearson and the Pioneer Fund, understand that this is an element of intellectual continuity between the eugenics and the racism of the past and the racism and the potential eugenics, euthanasia, and extermination programs of the future. Indeed, I would note parenthetically that in the long archive program, Radio Free America program number 16, AIDS, Epidemic or Weapon of War. By the way, that subject will be the topic of an upcoming lecture on May 21st in Santa Cruz. The very disturbing evidence that AIDS is not the naturally occurring disease that we were told, but rather some sort of a biological warfare weapon. Well, that evidence has gone into in that archive show. We should understand that when I'm speaking about the possibility of extermination programs, there is strong evidence to suggest that those programs are already underway, albeit in a somewhat surreptitious fashion. Of Roger Pearson and the new scientific racism, as described here by Stefan Kuhl and the Pioneer Fund, the author writes as follows. He begins by a UNESCO statement on race and racial prejudice from a meeting in Paris in September of 67. Racism falsely claims that there is a scientific basis for arranging groups hierarchically in terms of psychological and cultural characteristics that are immutable and innate. In this way, it seeks to make existing differences appear inviolable as a means of permanently maintaining current relations between groups. And then the main text proceeds, "The late 1980s witnessed a revival of public interest in scientific racism on North American campuses. The media gave broad coverage to research by scholars in the United States and Canada that attempted to establish a scientific basis for classifying humans into, quote, superior, unquote, and, quote, inferior, unquote, genetic groups. For example, J. Philip Rushton, or Philippe Rushton, R-U-S-H-T-O-N, professor at the University of Western Ontario, argued that whites and Asians are generally more intelligent and family-oriented than were blacks, while Johns Hopkins University sociology professor Robert Gordon advanced the claim that the high crime rate among American blacks correlated with their comparatively low intelligence level. And then of Roger Pearson, the author writes, "In 1991, anthropologist Roger Pearson jumped into the fray with what was probably the most comprehensive defense of scientific racism in the United States since 1945. In Race, Intelligence, and Bias in Academe, Pearson denounced, quote, the strong opposition by Marxists and other leftists, unquote, against research with racial implications. He attacked both academia and the media as bastions of politically motivated opposition to the pursuit of, quote, objective, unquote, science. Note these arguments by Roger Pearson. They're very similar to the types of arguments presented by the Third Reich in attacking those critics of its eugenics policies in the late 1930s. We'll come to that later. Continuing. Pearson's defense of research on questions of racial difference stems from a long-term personal investment in such research. He has been promoting the theory that the white race is endangered by inferior genetic stock for more than 30 years. In the late 1950s, he helped to found the Northern League and the journal Northlander, an initiative designed to foster the, quote, interests and solidarity of all Teutonic nations, unquote. By the way, remember the Northern League. We're going to touch back on that later. In 1978, he supported the World Anti-Communist League meeting in Washington, D.C., which the Washington Post referred to as an assembly of the forces of, quote, authoritarianism, neo-fascism, racial hierarchy, and anti-Semitism, unquote. Of course, in Radio Free America programs 14 and 15, we dealt extensively with the World Anti-Communist League, and in Radio Free America number 37, among other programs, came back to the profound connections between elements associated with that organization and not only the fascism of the 1930s and 40s, but also, among other events, the assassination of President Kennedy. More about that either later this evening or next week. Continuing. Pearson has succeeded in combining such right-wing politics with a conventional academic career. He served as director of the Council for Social and Economic Studies in Washington, and today leads the Institute for the Study of Man in McLean, Virginia. In his fundraising efforts for the Council for Social and Economic Studies, he proudly referred to a letter of support he received from President Ronald Reagan. On April 14, 1982, Reagan commended Pearson's, quote, valuable service, unquote, and voiced appreciation for his, quote, substantial contributions to promoting and upholding those ideals and principles that we value at home and abroad, unquote. That again from Ronald Reagan, and by way of illustrating that the intellectual viewpoints that I am analyzing in this program are not something that belongs to the past. Unfortunately not. They are something which belongs to the present and which unfortunately may very well dominate the future, barring a reversal of the chain of events. So note Roger Pearson, note his viewpoints exemplified by the Northern League and the Northlander to foster the, quote, interests and solidarity of all Teutonic nations. And note the degree of respectability that this individual has achieved, and beyond that, some of the powerful elements that he is connected with, including, obviously, Ronald Reagan, who thinks Pearson was just grand, and the World Anti-Communist League. Skipping down in Kuhl's text, in Race, Intelligence, and Bias in Academe, Pearson attempts to disassociate eugenics from the shadow cast upon it by the extermination programs of Nazi Germany. After 1945, enthusiasm for research in eugenics and race questions had sharply declined as the full horror of Nazi uses of eugenics and race science became apparent. In the 1970s, when some academics again argued for the genetic inferiority of blacks and the preeminence of heredity over environmental influences, critics readily drew associations to Nazi ideology. Such scientists were accused of promoting fascist ideas. Indeed, similarities between Nazi race ideology and racist research in the United States since 1945 have provided critics with a powerful means for attacking scientists with racist agendas. Skipping down, Pearson's, now here we're going to get into the Pioneer Fund, which has helped to fund the racist research of Roger Pearson. And as we shall see in the person or in the character of the Pioneer Fund, we have a direct connecting element between the American and German eugenics of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and which would lead directly to the Nazi extermination programs and the racist science and eugenics, which is resurgent in the United States and looked upon with favor in such circles as the former World Anti-Communist League and the Reagan administration. Continuing. Pearson's publications have been supported in part by the Pioneer Fund, a foundation whose early leadership had praised aspects of Nazi Germany's racial policies and which has in more recent years given financial support to controversial research into race and intelligence.